Hi, this is Paul Siegel. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and youtube.com/wanderingdms/live. And now, on with the show. Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and on this episode of Wandering DMs, we're going to be talking about the action economy in D&D. How much can you get done in a round, and how has that changed from chainmail to original D&D to first edition to fifth edition and everything in between, and which one is best? Hopefully you have an opinion about that, and you can tell us what your opinion is in the chat today on Wandering DMs.
Excellent. Before we get into that, Dan, we have like so many announcements backed up. We have a little bit to get through here. So I hope folks will forgive us for a moment for telling you about all the crazy stuff going on here at Wandering DMs.
I think I need a reminder myself, Paul. So I'm actually looking forward to this because I fear I might have forgotten one or two of the things myself.
Excellent. So, we got a few different things going on here. First of all, I will mention new Patreon benefits. We have we've been expanding our benefits to our various Patreon tiers, and one of the big things is we've started a private Discord for all our patrons, and that's available now. You can get onto the Patreon, or if you're already a patron on Patreon, you should get access to our private Discord server, where we are and we chat prior to the show. And sometimes we do things like poll people what kind of things they might want to hear us talk about in future shows. There's also a announcements channel there for stuff like when we post stuff. The 10 Dead Rats crew is generally on that Discord from time to time, so you might be able to chat with them a little bit. And we're also going to use it as recruiting grounds, right? That's the big news. For anyone following the development of the Big Bad, you might know that we have run several playtest groups through that, basically, strong-armed every friend we could into playing the thing with us before we started shooting. Realized after the fact, man, that's the perfect thing to leverage our patrons for. Like, we could, recruit from our patrons for playtest groups. I'm sure they would like to play some of those games, and we would love to have them come and test some of those games. So we'll use that for stuff like the Big Bed or like the game you saw us play live during my birthday for the Cheat Your Own Adventure game. So we're super excited to have kind of a player pool to draw from, and we hope you'll be excited to join us.
We've had a couple patrons suggest that in the recent past, and we were like, "Oh yeah, that's a great idea. We totally need to do that." So we're looking forward to interacting with folks a little bit more closely in the actual live play of our games.
excellent. Also, the patrons also get discount codes to our merch store. And I guess, surprise, surprise, we have a merch store. As Dan shows off there.
Is that a thing now? Is that right, Paul?
We do indeed. I'm just sitting here kind of futzing with my Zoom level because I want to show off. I am indeed wearing our Wandering DMs shirt. This is the Big Bad shirt. Actually, let's see if I can get up here and show you the back. If I can escape these wires. Okay. Can you see that all right?
Yes, I can. Great job.
Excellent. So we have a couple variations of that. We have a shirt that's just all the Big Bad just on the back and this logo. We also have the Big Bad all up front. And as Dan is showing you.
I always love the logo. I'm so glad we have the logo on merch now. I feel like I kind of want to talk to the person who designed it, but they're disappointed.
That logo mod does have, of course, the Big Bad on the other side.
Yeah. I've wanted this on the show so long, so other people should join us.
Yeah. We also have some stickers, the Big Bad stickers. Look at these are in ridiculously enormous Big Bad. big Bad
it's
stickers.
It's on topic. I like it. They're enormous because they're big. You don't want small, big, bad stickers. Right. That would not work. They need to be big.
There you go. I was not personally not expecting them to be quite so large, but there you go.
I knew it all along.
Great.
That was exactly part of my plan.
Excellent. I think that's about it for the Patreon side of things. What else is going on?
So again, if people have not seen that, of course, they can go to patreon.com/wanderingdms and join our current patrons as we roll out additional interactions and additional benefits for that. So thank you for the reminder of that, Paul.
Absolutely.
Let me see. So you also have, we have a subscription drive coming up this week. Is that right, Paul?
That's right. Specifically looking for folks to subscribe to the YouTube channel. And we are going to bribe you to do so. We'll be running a subscription drive over the first couple of weeks of September. And you'll see that we'll post that to our social media and to our website and et cetera. And basically, by joining in the subscription drive, you can get entries into a drawing for some pretty cool prizes.
I saw the list of prizes, and I was like, Paul, are you sure this is not too much? When I saw the list of prizes this morning, I was like, really? This is crazy. What is the secondary prize is what, Paul?
So the secondary prize is a complete collection of all the stuff you and I have published digitally. So that's the Book of War.
Everything.
That's the Book of Spells. That's My Adventures, R.A. Salvatore Presents, the Sister to the can't say my own titles. That's not good. R.A. Salvatore Presents the Vile Crypt of the Reawakened Sisterhood, and my most recent adventure, Mirror Mirror, which is available now on DriveThruRPG, and you can find that. Also, I'm happen to be doing another secondary giveaway for that on Twitter. So if you visit my Twitter at Paul's Gameblog. You can enter another drawing there to get a free copy of Mirror Mirror.
Great. And that's an adventure that you have both in 5th edition and OSR form, right?
Correct. That is why it's on drive-thru, so that I can have both versions. They're not terribly different. Don't go out and buy both. They're just the adventure just replaces monster stats and trap mechanics and whatnot. The stuff you would expect to be different between OSR and 5th edition.
Good, but our prize winners will get both.
Yeah, our prize winners will get both. That's right. Complete collection of everything. That's just the secondary prize. The grand prize, Dave? Right.
Well, the grand prize is, let me see, I gotta look this up here, the complete Wandering DMs collection personalized for you. So it's one of the t-shirts that Paul is currently wearing, one Big Bad t-shirt that's signed by both myself and Paul. Yep. Okay, reasonable. A print copy of Book of War with a personal inscription from me to you, whoever the grand prize winner is. Okay, I see that. A Dick of Spells box signed by both Dan and Paul, because we both worked on that. All right, we both signed that. Got it. And then a USB thumb drive containing everything in the secondary prize tier, digital copies of everything that we've ever done.
Yep.
So that seems a bit much, Paul, don't you think?
We will mail that to you. You will get one of everything. One of everything, and a few things with our scrawlings on it.
Anything that actually physically exists in the three-dimensional universe gets signed by us.
Yeah.
So, so great. So that's the grand prize from our subscription. Now, Paul, can people that are actually already subscribed participate in that?
Yes, absolutely. If you're already subscribed, you can still participate, and in fact you'll see that there are multiple ways to enter. The primary way, of course, first and foremost, it is a subscription drive, so the primary way is to subscribe to the YouTube channel, but then also for following us on various other forms of social media, you'll get extra entries into the drawing.
Great.
We'll be pushing that out.
Where do people go in order to participate with that?
The best place to look for that, I think, is probably our Twitter. It'll be announced there. I think we're expecting to launch it at the start of the month, so around tomorrow?
Tuesday. I think Tuesday is the Tuesday? First of the month.
Okay.
So I think
Great.
Yeah. So I think it'll run the 1st through the 20th of September, so the Tuesday of this week through about 3 weeks later.
Yeah, but we'll post it across all of social media, so it'll be on our Facebook page, and it'll be on our own website, and any place, anywhere and everywhere we can shout about it. And so please enter and help us share that information around and try and get more folks to enter as well. Our goal is to get our subscription numbers up. So
vote early and vote often, and you will have additional chances to be bribed successfully by the Wandering DMs. Isn't that great?
There you go. There you go. I think that about covers all of the nonsense. Yeah. So, what are we talking about today, Dan? What's our topic?
We are talking about the action economy, and this is something that we have brushed up against time and time again in our OSR classic D&D games, and then also our recent 5th edition shoots for the Big Bad. So it's been on our mind, and I've seen, like, and it's weird because once again, in the D&D social media verse, it has been coming up repeatedly in the last couple of weeks. So it's like on other people's minds as well. So what can you get done? What can one person get done in a round of D&D? And how does that affect what your encounters look like and what your interactions with the villains look like and things like that? So I'm going to start off with a trivia question. And this is going to affect a lot, like what's the turn sequence like in D&D? In original D&D, Paul, where can you find the turn order rules? Where can you find the initiative and turn order rules in original D&D? Now remember, original D&D had three volumes. It had volume one. It came in one box, right? And you know, three volumes in this box. Volume one is basically a little player's handbook. Volume two is basically a little monster manual, and volume three is a little DM's guide. So, in which volume can you find the initiative and turn order rules in original D&D?
I'm going to go out on a limb and say none of them. That it appears nowhere in the book whatsoever.
That is correct. Original D&D had no... Absolutely correct. You figured out where I was going with that. There's no rules for initiative. There's no rules for a turn order. There's no rules for how many actions you can... So Paul's correct. William is correct in the chat. No initiative, no turn order rules whatsoever. So what do you do with that? So this is... It's one of those interesting lacuna in original D&D that... It either seemed obvious or seemed unnecessary, and as a result, we have like an ongoing eternal debate about what you should have done when you're running original D&D. Now, the top solution is to go back to the prior game, Chainmail Mass Combat, and look at the turn sequence there. And let me ask: Does Chainmail? Here's my second trivia question: Does Chainmail have a turn sequence in those rules?
I'm guessing it doesn't, right? I'm willing to bet that they were building on just sort of like, well, you're a war gamer, you know how to play war games. We don't need to cover this stuff. Is that true?
A good guess.
Yeah. No.
William in the chat, what do you think? Is there a turn sequence in Chainmail, or anybody else in the chat? Anybody have a guess on that? I'll give you a second or two.
Here, while you're pestering folks, I'm actually going to reach back here because my personal favorite thing on turn order. Why does this have the expert book in it and not the backwards? Or do I just not have
always,
them?
Always.
Oh, like they both that. Have the expert book in it. Oh no, my props, my stupid props have failed me.
Paul, you're an expert, so you don't need the basic book. You have multiple rounds of expertise.
Drat, I thought for sure I would have a basic book here on me, and now I'm going to have to like pull up a PDF or something. But what I'm trying to get at is that the BX basic book has a chunk in it about turn order, which has always confused me. And I'm going to pull it up. So, okay, we have some guesses here in the chat. Joshua Macy asks, aren't there two, depending on whether it's man-to-man
Joshua
or not?
Joshua is correct. Yeah, my second trivia question was even more subtly a trick question, because I would say no, there is not a turn sequence. Yeah, there's two, and the player have to pick between the two proposed turn sequences. Now, basically, the difference between the two turn sequences there are: do you write down your orders on paper in advance or not? Really, that's the difference.
Interesting.
Other than that, they are similar. And they're similar to the later Swords and Spells book for D&D that some people use to fill in the gaps. Since it's a war game, it is very regimented. And in both cases, basically what happens is both players move half, and then they shoot, and then both players move another half, and then they shoot again and fight melees. And in each phase, each player does the same action effectively simultaneously. So both move, then both shoot, then both move again, then both melee. And that's the original chainmail sequence. And some people try to use that for D&D. Like I've seen someone in the last week think that they came up with that as a novel invention, actually. And I pointed out that's actually what happens in the original chainmail. And yeah, I think if you look at the BX rules, you see like a similar echo of that, this phased turn sequence.
Yeah, which is not surprising for a war game, right? But what is surprising, I think, you know, the thing, I'm looking now at the basic book, which says that the order events in one game turn are the DM rolls for Wandering Monsters. Sorry, I'm looking at the wrong section. That is the turn order outside. There is the combat sequence.
Page B24. Yes,
each side rolls for initiative. The side that wins initiative acts first. Yeah. If simultaneous all actions permanent at the same time, morale check, movement, missile fire, magic, melee, the side with the next highest initiative acts second, and so on, using the order given above until all sides have completed melee.
Yeah.
Which makes it almost sound like my whole side, right, all of our players all do our movement, and then all of the players all do missile attacks, and then all of the players all do magic, which is awkward, right? It's weird.
That's totally what that says.
Yeah.
That's totally exactly what that page says. Yeah. Now, at least you're not interleaving the two opposing sides. You've at least you've at least separated out the two separate sides. But yeah, everybody on one team has to go through each of those phases one step by step together. Did you ever actually do that, Paul?
No, never done it that way. You?
Yeah. I don't think so.
Yeah.
I don't think so. I think you know, because I started with the Holmes basic that came before that, that again, like original D&D, didn't have explicit rules for it. So I think I was doing something a little bit more hand wavy than that. And when I picked up BX and started running it for people, I probably didn't read that page super closely.
Well, I feel like we're trained, you know, from just more traditional board games in the process of taking turns, right? Like, I go, I do all my stuff. You go, you do all your stuff.
Yeah.
Around and around and around the table we go, right? So anything that bucks that, I think, is unusual, right?
And I agree.
Yeah, I can see the argument for it, right? Especially when you're talking about war games and you want to say, like, well, we're really doing here is we're simulating reality, so we want something that feels more real time, right? Until computers get involved, it's basically not really possible. So, you know, how do we chunk up time in such a way that makes sense?
And as someone that is really dedicated, someone like myself who's really dedicated to introducing new players to the game for the first time and making it an easy entry point, I mean, I don't mind that we've moved away from that. I like using people's intuition about what a standard board game looks like. Is you get a turn, you do all your stuff, it goes to the next person.
Yep.
And so I'm actually glad that we've gotten away from that. And it seems a lot easier to communicate. Like, you almost don't have to say anything to say, it's your turn. What are the things that you do? We're going to do all of them right now.
Right.
So that is one that appears in Chainmail and BX. And I'm glad that we got away from that.
All right. So we're trying to get to the point of talking about the action economy and what can you do in your, like, it's your round, like, regardless of how you split it up or what order it goes in. It's your turn to do things. How much can you do? And I think the first thing I want to ask is, well, how much time do I have? What is the length of one round, right?
Mm.
And even that, right?
That's
as we go from all right, so I can say in 5th edition, right, you're looking at 6 seconds. 6 seconds, right? I know that off the top of my head because one of the things I actually kind of like about 5th edition is a lot of spells will say that they last for 1 minute or parentheses 10 rounds.
So the briefest thing I can say is basically that's good. That is actually correct. It's like about 6, maybe 10 seconds is about what a round ought to be, frankly.
Yeah.
And you know, there's so in if you go back to chainmail,
let me just interject. Like, the reason I like that 5th edition does it that way is not only that it's a good value, which I think it is, 6 seconds is a good amount of time, but that they tie it back to real world time increments. That they say that they start off the text with saying the duration of the spell is 1 minute, which just I feel like really helps cement the idea of, like, we're not assuming combat, right? It's going to last a minute.
I can see that.
Okay, you're in combat that. Rounds. You need to know that that's 10 rounds.
And you're liking that in contrast to what?
I want to think that, like, earlier, like, maybe third edition books are all going to just say rounds and turns, right?
Gotcha. I'd have to look that up. Third edition might be right. I'm not going to look it up. But at some point, there was a transition. Certainly, we agree that in the earliest editions, it was in terms of rounds and turns. And then you have to interpret what that means, of course. And I can see the attraction to shifting it from the earliest editions, which were inches and turns, to feet and minutes, which you have now. And honestly, I don't actually use that in my original D&D writing to be consistent with the original books, but I can see the attraction of why you would want to do that to make it easy to interpret mentally.
Don't you do that for durations in Book of Spells? Isn't that?
I don't. It's all turns.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, it's still turns just like it is in original D&D, yeah. So William's saying third edition used rounds and minutes. So it kind of used a mishmash of both.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to think... Okay, I definitely have my 5th edition Thank you for that. Here. But I think I want to think 5th edition does both and it just inverts it. Nope, I'm wrong. It just says 1 minute. Okay. 1 minute, end of story.
I mean, some stuff has to have durations of rounds, right?
Sure. Well, some have duration of instantaneous, right? And then, I think that, certainly like casting times, we see casting times that are things like one action. Now you're getting into real nitty gritty of, there you go. Yeah. Guiding Bolt has a duration of one round.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So some do, but I think it's much more common to see things like 1 minute or here's one that lasts 10 days. That's fun.
Yep,
or 8 hours.
Yep. Something like water breathing or plant growth or something like that would have a longer duration probably. So let me ask one more. So my blog, which I think I started writing about 13 years ago, is primarily dedicated just to this issue. I mean, to a large degree, the canonical theme on my blog is how long is a turn and how big is an inch? And those scale issues are frankly the number one thing that I deal with on my blog. So there's approximately 13 years of writings that I have on this particular topic. And so I really need to restrain myself to rein it in. But So William's correct. In my Book of Spells, I leave things as turns. And then because it's shifted, right, in the between editions, you're right. I leave it up to the DM to interpret what the turn scale is in their game, because I'm trying to make it as compatible for, you know, friends of mine that have different interpretations of this. And of course, to make a long story short, in advanced D&D, the claim was that one round was a minute.
Yeah.
But at the same time, in original D&D, it sort of claims that one round is a minute, and then in the same year. TSR released Warriors of Mars, which is basically D&D for the John Carter Mars books, and there one round is 6 seconds. So weirdly, for Boot Hill, released in the same year. So even in the same year as the release of D&D, Gygax and company were using 6 seconds for a round, the same as what you see in 5th edition today, but for some reason, he got defensive in AD&D and claimed that it was like one full minute, which basically doesn't make any sense. So I'm happy to abandon that vestigial organ.
I mean,
and say it should be about 10 seconds.
Let me give you my argument for, and I know we still have yet to actually get into how much you can do. But let me give you my argument for why I actually prefer the other way around of real time first. Where it bites me in basic is this notion of that rounds are a subunit of turns, right? That one turn consists of multiple rounds. And how long is a turn in BX D&D?
It's 10 minutes,
right. So if we assume a 6-second round, then one turn is 60 rounds, right? And then when you get into the spells, a lot of the spells are in numbers of turns, and suddenly all of your spells are lasting multiple hours, which is surprising and weird, right? There are some spells in BX where you're like, really? This is going to 2 hours? I get to do this for 2 hours?
I agree.
And it's just...
I think that was, frankly, a mistake. So if you go back to... See, it's again, the root of these confusions and problems is really that in chainmail, man-to-man combat, Gygax did not specify a scale. Once again, that would be my third trivia question. You go to chainmail, man-to-man, he failed to specify a scale, and you get this weirdo, wonky confusion.
So here's my argument. Let me complete the argument here, which is that it's nice to see a spell that says it lasts 1 minute because you know in your head, like, well, for probably not a whole combat, right? Or maybe a whole combat if the combat is short and possibly it runs out mid-combat because it's an extended combat, right? That's what 1 minute tells me. And then how I subdivide that into turns or rounds or count it or whatever, I don't need to worry too much. Whereas when you have a text that just says, oh, it lasts for six turns or six rounds, and I go, oh, but I'm using this weirdo system where each round is a minute, like that's hugely different than if it's 10 seconds.
Well, as a matter of legacy, you're going to have a whole lot of first edition players that pick up your book, read the 1 minute duration, and then in their head, that'll go, oh, that's only one round.
Yeah, that's okay. Well, you're right.
So there's several million players out there that are going to pick that up.
So perhaps the real answer is that you probably ought to write both because you cannot make assumptions about if ultimately what you're writing here is a resource to be used across multiple systems, you probably need to be a little more explicit.
You need to be explicit. That's exactly what I was going to say. You need to be explicit, and it was a major failing that Gygax failed to write the scale in places like chainmail man-to-man, and original D&D is confusing in places, and there's some other thing that I picked up on recently where, once again, Arneson's Naval Combat. Arneson's Naval Combat that he wrote originally had, or his aerial combat, had specific scale written in, and when it got included in original D&D by Gygax, he stripped out the scale. He removed it, even though it was there to begin with. So for some reason, Gygax had a gesture whereby he kept removing scales, and that is super confusing, and you need to be explicit about it. Yeah. I don't know why he did that.
Okay, so let's get into the nitty-gritty here. The question is, it's your turn. How much can you do, right? And
are you about to yellow card me? Are you about to yellow card me, Paul? Because that's what it looks like is about to happen.
No, no. Just randomly have a something in my hand. Okay, so...
how much can you do in a round?
Yeah, how much can you do in a round, right? Right, like, regardless of how long you think a round is, and that is important, actually, how long you think a round is, because how much can I... Because then you want to apply logic. You want to say, well, a round is only this much time, so you can only do X, Y, Z. But the real question is, like, how much can you do before someone else gets to do something else, right? Like, you get a slice now. You get a slice of time to do whatever you want.
Yeah.
How much can you get done before somebody, you know, mucks up what you're attempting to get done?
Here's my broad thesis. Yeah. It's grown over time. Over the editions, it has become more and more generous about each character being able to do more stuff. And if you look in the early, with a couple exceptions, if you look at the early editions, it was fairly restrictive, maybe in the war game sense, and it gets more and more and more generous over time. So, for example, if you look at, let's say you look at the first place where he was really explicit, AD&D. The idiom in first edition was that you could either move or attack. You can't do both. You can either move if you're far away for melee, you got to spend your round moving up and getting in proximity, and then you could attack on the next round. You can't do both, with the single exception of there's a special charge action where you get to do both, but you can only do that once every 10 rounds. So generally speaking, you could move or attack. You want to shoot something, you must stand still. You can't move. You want to cast a spell, you must stand still. You cannot move in the same turn. And that was very consistent. Chainmail says that. Original D&D says that. Swords and Spells says that. First edition says that. If you're casting a spell, clearly that's your entire round. You can't move a bit if you do that. So it's fairly restrictive in that sense early on. And I could go on more about that, but that's the way it was in, say, around first edition, plus or minus an edition.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah, I don't know how quickly it came away from that. I mean, obviously, we just saw in BX that you can do all these different, right. You have all these different phases, right? You can do, you know, your movement and your casting your spell and your missile and melee and et cetera, I don't think it's, I'm not sure that it's implying that you can do all those things. I've never seen anyone try to interpret it that way of like, well, it's my round. I'm going to move and I'm going to shoot my bow and I'm going to cast a spell and I'm going to swing my sword.
That's a good point. It looks like you can, just looking at it right here, it looks like in BX you can move and you can melee, for example. There is a note that says spellcasters may not move and cast spells. So once again, that's the one place that they're really, really restrictive about. And it looks to me like in BX you can certainly move and still swing your sword.
Can I shoot my bow and swing my sword?
Up to the DM. I hope you've got a DM that says no, because that's really what the answer ought to be.
Well, that's really like, okay, so here's the question, right? How many times can I swing my sword? Let's say I'm going to swing my sword. How many times can I do that?
Right.
How many times now, do the dice hit the table?
Now, clearly in BX, one.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
In BX, clearly one, end of story, that's it. For, right. Like, you know, for a player character or a human being.
Which is probably the logic you're going to fall back on to say, no, of course you can't both swing your sword and shoot your bow. You get one attack.
Right.
One attack. You pick which one you want. And then people are probably going to argue like, well, what about what's in your hands and can you get things out of your pack and how much of your turn does that take?
Right.
But yeah, can't do both.
And so, you know, obviously in early editions, that question you just brought up about how much other stuff can you do was loosey-goosey. It was not formalized the way that it is now starting like around third edition. And in fact, there's a passage here in first edition I'd actually like to read here. So this is the first edition DM's Guide, page 71. And there's a section that says actions during combat and similar time important situations. And more or less, I mean, there's no hard rules. It's just like you're going to have to think it through as the DM. And so there's a part that says, for example, quote from a presumed player. Player says, in this round, I'll hurl oil at the monster, ignite it, drink my potion of invisibility, sneak up behind it, and then stab it in the back. How ambitious indeed, it says. And then there's a paragraph where it kind of goes, well, part by part, this part could take one or two segments of the round, and maybe that part might be maybe three or four segments. And at the end of that paragraph, Gygax concludes, therefore, all those characters' actions will fill something over two complete rounds, is what he's estimating. So,
that's where it gets me. Like,
exactly.
Anytime I've seen anyone try to actually use segments, it's just it's a nightmare. It's a nightmare.
I agree, but I feel like that's a pit that you fall into when you want to claim that a round's a whole minute. A minute's a pretty long time in a fight, and I think probably a martial arts instructor would say most fights don't last a whole minute in the real world. So as soon as you say that your rounds are 1 minute each, you fall into this pit about all the other stuff you can do in a minute.
Right.
And then in first edition, Gygax had to slice a round up into 1/10 of a round segments, and now you're debating that instead.
So interestingly, I wanna talk a little bit here about fifth edition, right? So in fifth edition, by the time we get to five, and I understand how we got here, but fifth edition for me is the set of rules where it's a real strong exercise in taxonomy, right? Fifth edition wants to compartmentalize label everything, right? To the point where oftentimes, like, just trying to figure out, well, what does this mean involves, like, three cross-references, right? Like, I'm paralyzed. Yeah. What does that mean? Well, paralyzed means you're also incapacitated. All right, well, what does incapacitated mean?
Yeah.
Right, okay.
Right.
I get it. I see why they want everything to be keyworded so that then it's very easy. It does make some things easy, like the one place I see that actually help is I think somebody has an ability of, like, immune to or resistant to or gets a bonus to resisting charm effects. And then you're like, well, what's a charm effect? And I can pretty confidently say, does it have the word charm in there? If it doesn't have the word charm anywhere in the text, it's not a charm.
Right. We've had that debate come up twice, I think, in the Big Bad Shoots, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, so the trivia question for our viewers in the chat is the command spell a charm effect? I'll leave you to ponder that one. So here's the interesting thing. So what they ended up doing, right, is you end up with, okay, so you get a move and you get an action. And then they start doing things where sometimes you get to do extra stuff. You have stuff like fighters who, when they use the attack action, can swing multiple times. They can make multiple attacks per attack action. So now we're like subdividing the action up. And they have the bonus action, right?
Yeah.
And again, I kind of understand why they got here, and I don't mind it, but I also kind of hate it. I don't know. The idea behind a bonus action is some classes we want to give the ability to do something extra, right? Yeah. Oh, you get a free X. And then the problem with that is, well, what happens when it piles up? Does it stack? Now I can do 20 free things. And so what they've done is they've kind of classified all those things as bonuses, and they can say you can do one bonus action per round, and I think that's actually reasonably elegant, right? Of like, okay, you know, we're giving you all these extra things, but we're limiting the number of extra things you can do. Likewise, they did the same thing with reactions, right? So each person also has one reaction per round. This is our classic fix to the attack of opportunity problem of, I stand here and I wipe the whole board because everyone provokes attacks of opportunity from me and I made 20 attacks in the course of one turn. You get one reaction. So you get an attack of opportunity from me, somebody else does something to provoke an attack of opportunity. I already used my reaction, sorry, can't do it again.
Right.
Which I think is...
I'll interject here that I mean, this looks a lot like 3rd edition to me. So 3rd edition D&D is really where they started this really rigorous formalization. And you get a whole page in 3rd edition of, here's the thing you'd want to do. Here's what type of action it counts as. Standard action, full action, move action, something.
But they didn't They didn't put the limiters in, right? So they did stuff like, you know, they certainly didn't have, like... You know, you can only do one of these per round kind of stuff.
They did have that. They absolutely had that. Yeah, the rule in the basic rule in 3rd edition is, just like 5th edition, is like you can do one move action, you can do one standard action, or you can do a full action which replaces both of those.
Right. But they didn't have the concept of bonus or reaction, right? So there was a lot of stuff that is, this is triggered by X, or you get to do this for free, and then it was just, you get all of it, right?
That is a detail that slightly changed. They had the idea of a free action, which to my mind...
But you could do an unlimited number of free actions, right? You could do as many free actions as
you want. I'd have to look it up.
I believe that's the case. I don't think the limits came in until 5th.
In broad strokes, 5th edition looks remarkably like 3rd edition in how formalized it is. Yes, some of those details are slightly changed.
I agree.
And everything you're saying about 5th edition is correct, of course.
I agree with you that 5th edition is more formal, but I would say I believe it is more elegant than 3rd. I believe it has put more thought into refining a lot of that stuff that was a little broken in 3rd. I see you disagree with me. I disagree with you. I think we're just not going to come to terms on this one. It's fine. This is not the point I'm trying to make.
I know that many people agree with Paul. And again, as you know, to a maybe slight outsider to 5th edition, it looks so much like 3rd edition. I'm going to have to pay attention to those formal rules one way or the other. I'm going to have to dig into that and learn these formal rules that didn't exist in original D&D.
Yeah. I'm not saying by any means that it's perfect and that I love it, right? I think I've said many times, I kind of have this love-hate relationship with the action economy in 5th edition. I think it solves a lot of problems. But here's the question. Has it brought us to the point where we no longer have to do any interpretation and everything just has a rule? The answer is decidedly not. And I'll illustrate by reading to you my favorite action type, which is use an object. Normally interact with an object while doing something else, such as when you draw a sword as part of an attack. When an object requires your action for its use, you take the use an object action. This action is also useful when you want to interact with more than one object on your turn. Okay.
Interesting.
What is drink a potion?
Well, now we're right back at the first edition clause. We are right back at the first edition clause where someone wants to do a bunch of stuff and drink a potion of invisibility, and now we're going to have an argument about whether that fits in a round or not. And even in first edition, Gygax came up with something more than two rounds and a fraction more, right? And we're right back there again, all over again with fifth edition. And there's been an argument recently about how long does it take to drink a potion.
Yep. Here's the other section from the 5th edition rules that's important to reference here. It says, movement and position. In combat, characters and monsters are in constant motion, often using movement and position to gain the upper hand. I don't know that that's actually relevant to this block that I'm about to read. Interacting with objects around you. Here are a few examples of the sorts of things you can do in tandem with your movement and action. Draw and sheath a sword. Open or close a door. Withdraw a potion from your backpack. Pick up a dropped axe. Etc, etc, etc. I think there's in here... is there drink all the ale in a flagon? Drink all the ale in a flagon. Okay, so can I drink a potion? Well, it says that I can draw, withdraw a potion from my backpack,
right?
As part of my movement, it says I can drink all the ale in a flagon. Can I do both?
Right.
Can I withdraw the potion and drink the whole thing?
Right.
Personally, the way I've landed on this is no. One of those two things. If you've already got the potion in your hand, you can drink it as part of your movement. If you've got to fish it out of your pack, now we're in. It's taking your action.
Yeah, one of the things you said there is like one of the examples in there was draw a sword, and here on page 71 in first edition, you know, there's at least a couple examples there of a character needs to drop a crossbow, draw out their sword, and therefore they can't attack this round. So that's among the ways that it got more generous. And again, third edition was the first place where it said, as long as you can make an attack, you can simultaneously draw out your weapon at the same time. And when I got to third edition and I saw that, I was like, oh, giving away the farm, too generous. And so I kind of like running my original D&D games, as you know, Paul, whereby at least for non-scabbarded weapons, you actually do have to take a whole turn just to draw it out.
Yeah.
And there's tension, and there's drama, and there's pain over the fact that you lose your turn if you need to switch weapons.
I think this fifits into 5th edition reasonably well, right? It says specifically that as part of your move, you can unsheathe a weapon such as a sword, something like that. I think I just read it. Anyway, I still interpret it the same way that you're talking about here, which is to say, if it's a sheathed at the ready, like on your waist, just grab and pull, then yes, you can do that as part of your movement. Is it a giant axe strapped to your back?
Right.
Nope. That's more effort. And I like that's a special thing about swords in particular, right? Swords and daggers were built this way, that they became the dominant weapon because of many things, including the ability to quickly get them in hand.
Right. I like that. So that's part of my OED house rules, specifically that swords and daggers you can pull out instantly, unlike other weapons. So that's something that I really actually works really, really well in my games personally. Back to potions. I'm looking at the Swords and Spells original D&D supplement here, and there's a table about how long it takes to do different magical actions. So there's an immediate effect column, there's takes half a turn, there's takes a full turn. So like in particular, the higher the level of spell, the longer the casting time is going to be. Under immediate effect, it has like low level spells, rings, wands, staves.
Mm-hmm.
Potions don't appear anywhere on this list. So according to this list in Swords and Spells, you just can't use a potion in a fight at all. And at least when people are actually actively in melee, that is still my ruling, is if you try to like reach into your pouch, pull out a drink, and imbibe it and actually ingest it while someone's trying to run you through with a sword, my ruling is they just automatically smash the potion out of your hand.
Interesting.
How do you feel about that ruling like that, Paul? Is that how you would rule that? Or can someone actually actively in melee pull out a potion and drink it while they're in a fight?
I would let them pull out a potion and drink it while they're in a fight.
Interesting.
But again, that's your whole round, I think. Generally, you know, unless you ran into the combat with one of your hands occupied by said potion ready to go.
You start
to ask that, like, players are going to logic this. Here's the thing. Players are going to logic this.
Right.
So you're going to say, oh, you can smash, I can knock, I can smash the thing out of your hand. Well, I'm going to invent a better container. I'm going to use metal and not glass. I'm going to attach it in some way. I'm going to hold the healing mushroom in the cheek of my mouth, right? Like,
but that's awesome.
now it's awesome.
Yeah, that's awesome. And there's a D20 roll to see if you start choking on it. Don't forget that part. There's always a downside.
I mean, it's interesting to note that I'm fairly certain, I'm going to look it up now and make sure I'm right about this, but I'm fairly certain, actually, that drinking a potion is something that that Matt Mercer house ruled in Critical Role. And I think he calls it a bonus action.
That's crazy. And I know a bunch of people recently have been saying that, and I've seen discussion around that, and that is just way too much, right? Way too much to have a flagon of liquid being carted around in the middle of a melee, in the middle of a boxing match, and somehow getting it in your mouth without it being smashed and a bunch of glass in your lips and being able to digest it. That is a bridge.
Well, again, way now we're going to get into questions like, what is the container? I mean, if I'm used to doing this, I wouldn't use glass. Mm-hmm. I would use metal. How big is it, right? How much liquid is a potion? Some people think of it more as kind of test tube size. Some people think of it as, you know, giant, you know, flagon of ale sized, right? Like, how much liquid is it?
Okay, so for me, I feel like the test tube size is a back filling to rationalize the being able to do it in one round. And if you go back, let's say you pick up a random piece of art of a wizard at their workstation. Mm-hmm. It could be something from Tolkien, could be something from Harry Potter, right? How big is a standard flask of liquid that the witch or the wizard hands you in a story? I would argue that it's probably not test tube size. It's probably like about this mug, right? It's probably what you see in a piece of art like that.
Agree or disagree? I would say it depends on the effect of the potion and what kind of potion it is. How big in any movie, film, whatever you've ever seen, when someone poisons someone's drink, how big is that poison? How big is that, right? How much liquid do they dump into your drink to poison you?
Well, okay, but that's not being called a potion.
That's a potion of poison, right?
A magic potion. Okay, so you're picking on one corner case, and it's always the corner cases that produce bad rules.
I'm talking magical potion. I wouldn't, I guess I would really hesitate to say, like, well, I'm going to look at just artwork, because of course artists are always going to make it larger so that it's eye-catching. You know, potions are exciting when they're big, you know, bubbling things, you know, glass,
right,
brightly colored, and etc., etc.
And that's where it ought to be.
I personally, for me, for my games, if I was more on the ball, I would say it varies wildly. I would say it's not consistent from one to the next potion. Why be boring and have a one uniform size of all potions?
Well, because then it turns into a game mechanic about whether someone can drink it in one round or not.
Yeah, but I always allow them to drink it in one round, so screw it.
Yeah, but that's crazy, Todd. Don't do that. Crazy. That's nuts. That's nuts. Crazy.
Nope.
That's nuts.
Disagree.
That's too much. That's just too much. Just getting it out of the pack, getting it out of a big cluttered pack would need to take at least one round. And if you're getting stabbed in the face with a sword, that would probably foil it. So as an old schooler, I stick to the more restrictive stuff.
But what if you're not directly in melee combat? What if you're, you know, I'm in the back. I'm not in melee combat. I can get out my potion and drink it. Okay. But you just don't allow it in melee combat. So now it's not really about action economy at all. It's about situational influence.
All right, let's move to another topic. This is clearly going to take another hour, unfortunately. So there's going to be a part two to this. Yeah. But let me make a critique. About a separate thing from the potion issue, and that is how much can you interleave your moving and your attacking. So you go to chainmail, and clearly or swords and spells, and you got to do all your movement, and then attacking happens at the end of the round. Mm-hmm. And you see that in BX, right? You see that in BX, you got to do all your moving, and then the last phase of the round is to attack.
Yeah.
Now you move forward to third edition, and third edition was the first edition that says you can move and attack in any order. You can attack and then move, or you can move and attack. They're going to be two distinct actions, but you can put them in any order. Now, to my mind, the problem with this is that it creates a problem with when do you withdraw? I can, on a particular round, I can attack and then I can run away, and I can get one extra attack in before the responder does. Yep. How do they solve that? Well, here comes attacks of opportunity. So in order to solve the withdraw issue, that's where the attacks of opportunity come in, which aggrieves me to no end. And to me, the much more elegant solution of that is keep the phased nature of you can move, then you can attack in that order. And if you're withdrawing, you can move away, but then you don't get to attack, which also makes sense from a simulationist aspect to me of inertia-wise. If I'm running at you with an axe, it makes sense that my axe is coming at you and the end of my move, I can hit you. But if I'm trying to get away, it doesn't make sense that simultaneously I'm trying to get away from you and I'm also hitting you with my axe as I move away. That's not going to make a really great effect. So both from a game angle and a simulationist angle, I think it's the right thing that you can move and attack in that order. Now, third edition says you can do them in either order, which bothers me and requires the attacks of opportunity. Now, fifth edition comes along and one-ups that and says you can actually intermix your actions in your movement in any ad hoc way that you want. Mm-hmm. So you can go a third of your movement and then take your action and then another third of your movement and take your bonus action, take the rest of your movement. And I got to say, in the times that we've been playing with fifth edition rules, that is really confusing. And in particular, it always causes everybody to have to go, wait a minute. So I moved and then I did this and I did my three attacks. I guess I have some movement left. How much did I move? And we go back and we go, how many spaces did we move and how much do I have left? And that really bugs me in fifth edition.
I think there's a real yin and yang to this. So on one hand, I agree with you that the added complexity of the fifth edition economy slows the game down. Right. Inevitably, it slows the game down because there's so many more things I can do and so many more options and so much more tracking that inevitably it makes the game move slower, which is, I think, really unfortunate. On the flip side, I prefer a system that is a little more loosey-goosey and allows for more interpretation because I think you're never going to escape interpretation. That no matter how hard you try to regiment the rules, there's always going to be a case where you need to interpret. And I'm a big fan of the OSR mantra of rulings, not rules. So I want a system that's going to enforce less so that I can get in there and interpret on a per case-by-case basis.
Yeah, I agree with that. And less book lookups and less that you're expecting all the players to remember. In fifth edition, every round we have to ask the question, what is your move and what is your standard action? What is your bonus action? What is your reaction?
But I would argue that stuff like intercommingling movement and attacks actually simplifies the memorization aspect of the rules. It allows for more interpretation because the rule is, well, whatever. You can do any of it.
In practice, what I've seen is that it slows it down because you have to backtrack and think about what partial move did you make before this and then subtract and then come up with the other part.
I agree that it slows it down. I'm not arguing that. I'm arguing that it allows for more interpretation as well. I think that they're two separate things. On the one hand, yes, it slows it down. On the other hand, it opens the door for more interpretation and more flexibility.
The from what I've seen, the trade-off is a net penalty. Is a net negative for me. If I was seeing fifth edition play of I run past that window and as I go by I throw out the bomb, and that's all one single description, I would be great. That should happen and that's a legitimate adjudication. But in practice, what I've seen in fifth edition is the slowdown. Yep. Really is more it's worth than it's worth.
My opinion is that it is different. It is neither better nor worse. Yeah. It is different.
Yeah. I'm pretty critical of it and it's
okay. Well, at least we both agree that you're
not
wrong.
What I would want.
I've stymied him with a non sequitur.
the paradox that cannot be computed. That is true. That didn't make any sense at all.
No, of course it didn't. Of course it didn't. I delight, Dan, when you're clearly in a very logical train of thought of giving you something totally illogical.
Well done. A successful riposte of that nature. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah, it's definitely... I mean, the slowness is a real bummer. I gotta say, it's a real bummer.
Yeah.
I would love 5th edition to go faster.
It's not optimal. Yeah.
It can go faster if everyone has spent a lot of time studying, right? Which is not great. That's not a great solution, but it is a solution.
I haven't seen it yet. And really? I remember this discussion in 2005 when we're playing 3rd edition. I thought that would happen. I said, well... 3rd edition is slower, and I'm sure that once we all learn it, it'll get faster. It never got faster. And after 8 years, I was like, that's it. I'm pulling the plugs.
I think on review of some of the episodes of The Big Bad, that you will see some of them go quite a bit faster than others, because the team just knows the rules innately and is just executing and without asking questions. And just, I do this, boom, 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 go.
That is true, and it's still not quite as fast as an OSR game.
True.
Yeah.
True.
Yeah. It never quite gets that right. That right. Snappy.
Well, I think the trade-off there is that the OSR game is faster simply because it's basically moved to the opposite extreme of, like, it's impossible to know exactly. So you just have to ask, can I do XYZ? No, you can only do XY. Yeah. Okay, fine. That's what I do.
And I like describing, you know, I like being able to describe the actions in an immersed sense of, like, I'm going to run up and hit him, as opposed to I use my move action to cross that distance, and I use my attack action to hit him, and I use my bonus action to use the advantage that I get on the attack, right? So I would certainly prefer to hear descriptions, you know, in a more immersive, God help me, narrative sense, than to have to. So I'd rather interact with the world than interact with the game rules when someone's describing what they want to do.
Yeah, I agree with that. And it's much harder to achieve that in 5th edition, I would say. I've played 5th edition with plenty of folks who are brand new to roleplay, who've never done it at all.
Right.
And they feel quite overwhelmed because they're trying to deal with all the rules and try to understand it. And I have to really push very hard to say, let go. Just let go.
Yeah.
We will tell you how it fits in the rules. Just tell us what you want to do.
Yeah.
That's a tough sell. That's a tough sell.
You know what? It's funny because just this morning on Twitter, actually, WebDM Jim and I were interacting a little bit in this exact same thing in terms of character creation and what happens in your first session for brand new players versus maybe slightly more experienced players about how to induct them into the game and not be overwhelmed. And so we were just talking about the same kind of issue this morning, as a matter of fact.
Doesn't this play into... I can't remember the quote here, and you'll remember it hopefully, of the notion that as a game progresses, it caters more and more to the expert players.
Yes, that is the what's his name who created Magic the Gathering?
Okay.
I always forget his name, and if
Garfield?
Matt Garfield. No? Thank you, Richard Garfield. Right, Richard Garfield. Famous essay on exactly that part, and in particular about squeezing randomization out of a game as it goes on. Historically, at one point, chess had dice in it, and then it was removed. And now better chess players can with confidence, beat all newcomers. Mm-hmm. On the War Game show last night, right, the Book of War War Game show last night, I'm currently losing in the last six shows by a 4-2 margin. So Isabel beat me at my own game again last night, partly because I was getting crappy dice rolls, partly because she's a really good player, actually. It might have been William last night, actually, saying it's a sign of what a well-designed game is that I lose at it all the time. Because it's, you know, it's something that a beginner can possibly pick up and do play perfectly well against me. Yeah. So that's part of what Garfield was talking about. Jeez, now I'm on that tangent. But you're right. Games get more Baroque over time.
Yeah, but I mean, I guess I wasn't getting at the notion of whether or not you can be competitive in the game, but merely like, can you extract fun from the game? Can you extract enjoyment from the game? And I think it's actually the more complex the game, the harder it is for a newcomer to have a great first time with it, right? I think totally. I think new players to 5th edition, players coming in brand new to 5th edition, it probably takes them a couple of sessions before they before it clicks, before they get it, right?
Yeah. Whereas
I was going to say, I played plenty of first-time players in an old-school edition where, like, immediately after the first session, they are hooked. They are like, this is amazing. I need to do this all the time.
I've seen that so many times, and, you know, and someone this morning made a great point about, like, for new players, they stick with roll your abilities in order and then pick a class based on that because it's easier to interface with new players. And they said, I never allow reordering abilities or point buy. That's only for expert players. And even I hadn't really thought about that, but I'm reconsidering whether for first time players, I don't just make them roll their abilities in order like we did in 1974. So there's a lot of stuff like that. I care very, very deeply about what the brand new role-playing experience is because I want to be able to share that with as many people as possible. And when things get baroque and things get hard to induct new people in a fun way, that always, always hurts me. So starting with 3rd edition, when things got really, really formalized, it started to be like, it never got to a point where I was really happy with it at that point.
Is this why, I know we're pushing time, oh geez, I really should rein us in, but I almost wonder if this maybe explains the rise of streaming with 5th edition, right? Like, as sports became more complicated, right? And required more professional level players, right? More and more we became passive viewers of the professionals performing the sport.
Great, painful observation. Great, painful observation. Yeah. And it becomes more and more important, you know, because people, you know, are talking, like, so I'm arguing with about session zero at the moment, right? And as it becomes more complicated, you need more of a ramp-up time, and maybe people have to watch an entire season of Critical Role before they feel comfortable about jumping into a game, which hurts to come out of my mouth, but maybe that's part of the current trends.
Interesting. All right, well, we are clearly out of time. Dan, any final thoughts on the action economy of D&D?
Yeah, but in order to see that, people are going to have to tune in 2 weeks, and we've got to do part two of this because I didn't even get to the actual action economy part of my thesis today. Damn it! So we are actually going to have to really do another episode on this because there's a whole we didn't even get into like how this interacts with you versus the villains versus the characters versus the combat. Okay. So I apologize, but that was just the beginning part of this.
All right, great.
Painful episode. That might have been like among the more painful episodes in a lot of ways. That was like
funny.
Hard to grapple with, and we disagree with a bunch of stuff. And like, you know, I want things to be good for brand new players, and this, you know, the level of formalization has, you know, hurts me. And that's why circa 2007, I said, I'm done with 3rd edition and I'm going to go back to original D&D, which I just discovered, because it runs and it flows in ways that make me happier.
Interesting. Yeah, I guess personally, I've always been of the opinion that variety is the spice of life, and I want more options to do things differently, more ways with different people. And you know, it's one of the delights for me, honestly, when folks come over to my house, if I have a random group of people hanging out and I have this ridiculous giant shelf of board games and they say, let's play a board game, there's a kind of a delightful moment for me personally where I turn into the board game sommelier and I say, okay, well, what do I know about this group and what game is appropriate for them and their tastes in the current situation? I think that's super fun, and I like that in role play as well.
For some reason, I tend to hang out with people that are less hardcore gamers and wouldn't even have opinions to begin with about that. So I'm always in a situation where I am bringing people into role-playing or wargaming or even simply board games for the very first time. And I wouldn't even have a background for which I could sommelierize their experience.
I don't know. I think that then it becomes about reading the room, right? And you're sort of like, well, what's the energy like? Are we laughing, having a good time? Do we want something that fits in half an hour, or do we want a 2-hour experience? Do we want to like engage with rules and compete? Do we want a lighthearted comedic thing? Like, what does this group want right now? And how do I...
Well, what they're going to get is Lovecraftian terror with the glaze of wargaming. That's what they're going to get. Whether they like it or not.
Well.
What? You're giving your players a choice, Paul? What the hell is that? Heretic! Heretic!
All right. With that, we are clearly over time. Viewers, if you have any opinions, especially if you have thoughts about stuff you feel like we missed in Action Economy and you want to see in 2 weeks when we come back to this topic again, let us know. Leave a comment here in the video, and we will study that carefully before we come back in 2 weeks to reevaluate this topic.
2 weeks-ish.
Yeah. 2 weeks-ish. Yeah. Assuming we remember to do it and aren't then, you know, immediately have our heads turned in 2 weeks by some other new bright shiny.
Well put. Yes, please give us comments, and I would look for other advice on whether we're going the right direction with these critiques or not. Remember that if you're new to the channel, you can like and follow and subscribe to us on both YouTube and Twitch, where we simulcast all of our shows. And we are also on social media, such as Twitter and Facebook, for all of our upcoming announcements.
Yep. And you can also listen to our show in audio-only podcast format, which is available on our website at wanderingdms.com. You can also find that our podcast via other carriers like Google Podcasts and iTunes. And if you are listening to this podcast in one of those sites, please take a moment to rate and review us. That helps us out a lot.
We definitely do. Thank you to all of our current patrons. You'll see a list of them in the exit credits here in a minute. And they really help us out so much with this show, our talk show, The Big Bad that we'll have a new dev diary for on Tuesday, 10 Dead Rats you're supporting, Paul's show on Thursday, our wargaming show on Saturdays that might be in another 2 weeks or things like that. If you'd like to join our patrons and all of our new upcoming benefits like discount on merch, our private Discord server, surveys about things you'd like to see coming up, please do visit patreon.com/wanderingdems and join, and we would really appreciate that. As well as look for our subscription drive starting the 1st of September, and there'll be links on our wanderingdms.com website, as well as social media like Twitter and Facebook, and you'll probably hear more about it on our upcoming shows as well. Did I forget anything, Paul?
I don't think so. I think you're good. Yep.
Look for Paul's new Mirror adventure on Drive-Thru RPG in both 5th edition and OSR form. So pick the one that's correct carefully, please, and get that version of Mirror. I implore you.
Yeah. Look on my Twitter at Paul's Game Blog. Just at Paul's Game Blog. Or actually the blog itself, which is paulsgameblog.com. But on Twitter specifically, there is currently a giveaway being run. So if you want a free copy, look for one of those tweets, retweet it, and you'll be entered for a drawing for a free copy.
Fantastic. I'm so glad you're doing that, Paul. We'll be back on Tuesday for the Dev Diary, but our most recent shoot team that we are happy to reveal, and a new character and what we've been doing on the week, which is a whole lot of reviews and edits, frankly, among other things. And then, of course, we're live every Sunday for the show that you're currently watching, the Wandering DMs Talk Show, 1 p.m. Eastern Time every Sunday. So please join us next week for another debate-filled, thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.